Mild tea. Not helpful in the AM. That was a mistake. I should have taken your advice and taken the green tea. Yeah, this is really not good at all. It's kind of yummy. But. Okay, so today we're going to finish our lightning review of all of quantum field theory. Actually, there's, for me, an interesting little personal irony, because today in the morning, I'm going to extol all the absolutely beautiful virtues of this way of putting particles together into fields, build local interactions, etc., tell you why this almost completely constrains what the interactions between the particles in nature can look like, and what I've actually been working on in my research for the past 2 or 3 years is a frontal assault on trying to completely tear down this entire structure and replace it by another way of doing quantum field theory, which I just so happen to be talking about in the afternoon today. So, and in another talk, in another series of lectures. So the timing is precipitous and interesting. I'll have to deprogram myself from how wonderful this is to remind myself why it's so awful. And we have to do things differently. But it's actually wonderful. So our first order of business is to figure out how to talk about all these particles all these particle states that we introduced yesterday in a slightly more convenient way. What we talked about yesterday was what a particle is. Even in a non-relativistic theory, you can think of a particles as just being the states in the Hilbert space that on which the symmetries of translations and rotations act as nicely as possible. So even non-relativistically, particles are a single particle state is labeled by its momentum and by its spin. And we saw in a Lorentz invariant theory, the situation is a little more interesting. And depending on whether the particles are massless or massive, when they're massive, they continue to be labeled by their momentum and their spin. And when they're massless, they're labeled by their momentum and their helicity. But for the beginning of this discussion today, it's not going to matter too much whether it was Lorentz invariant or non-Lorentz invariant. What does matter is that if we have one particle, we might have two particle states, three particle states, many particle states, and even for the same momentum, right? So for exactly the same momentum, I can have a state with one particle with that momentum, two particle with that momentum, and so on. If we have the number of particles we can have depends on this, depends on whether the particles are fermions or bosons, right? So if we have bosons, for a fixed momentum, we can have an arbitrarily many particles with that momentum. And with fermions, we can only have as many of them as there are independent components of the spin. So two, if there's spin a half, we can't have more than two, one for the downspin, one for the upspin component, in exactly the same state. So the Hilbert space of the theory then decomposes into sectors with one particle, two particle, three particle. For bosons, an infinite number of particles. For fermions, this finite number that we talked about. And then there's one of those stacks of Hilbert spaces for every momentum, right? For every different momentum, we have all of these states. So what we're interested in is not just talking about free particles, we're interested in talking about interactions between the particles eventually. So the interactions are going to be described by some Hamiltonian, right? And that Hamiltonian is going to, I could give you the Hamiltonian just by telling you what does that Hamiltonian do to all the states in the Hilbert space, right? But we're going to do exactly the same thing, but just as a convenience, in order to not to carry around in our head what this big Hilbert space looks like, we are going to, just for our convenience, introduce, in fact, define what we'll call creation and annihilation operators that just let us keep track of all these states in a simple way. Okay? So, and also in particular, keep track of whether they're bosons or fermions, all the symmetrization, anti-symmetrization that you might have to do with states when you have identical particles will be taken care of just trivially by the teeny tiny bit of machinery we're going to introduce. So there is a vacuum state in the theory you might call zero. And then we're just going to define. So there are one particle states that we just talked about yesterday, right? These one particle states, we're going to simply, so this one particle state, I'm going to define this to be A of P and sigma dagger acting on the ground state. Okay? So in fact, perhaps I should have put it on the side. This defines what the operator A dagger is. I just gave you what the operator A dagger does. Okay? The operator A dagger acts on the ground state to produce one of these states. These are the primary things. These are the things that we just talked about yesterday. Okay? This is now just a convenience for our private edification be able to talk about these states in a nice way. Let's say I have a two-particle state, P1, sigma 1, P2, sigma 2. Then that'll just be A, P1, sigma 1, dagger. A, P2, sigma 2, dagger, acting on the ground state, and so on. And, well, similarly, we can talk about the states A, right? So the states A, the operators A would annihilate the vacuum, and A would take some state P and sigma and remove the particle and so on. In fact, let me it's clear what I mean by analogy there. Now, already here there's something very nice. We can encode whether the particles are fermions or bosons very simply in commutation or anti-commutation properties of A. Right? So if the particles are bosons, we take these operators A dagger. These operators A dagger satisfy that the commutator of A dagger for some P1 and sigma 1, and the commutator for some P2 and sigma 2 is equal to zero for bosons. That just says that the state that you get doesn't depend on the order in which you act. So the state P1 sigma 1, P2 sigma 2 is equal to the state P2 sigma 2, P1 sigma 1 with no minus sign. Okay? So bosons mean that these operators commute. But plainly, if the particles are fermions, that means that these operators should be taken to anti-commute. Okay. So if they're fermions, we should satisfy that the anti-commutator, that's what the curly bracket is, P1 sigma 1 and A dagger P2 sigma 2 is equal to 0. That guarantees that the state P1 sigma 1, P2 sigma 2 is equal to negative P2 sigma 2, P1 sigma 1, which is the symmetry property you're supposed to have under exchanging particles, if they're fermions. And so clearly, the same thing is true if I replace the A's by the A daggers. Just the Hermitian conjugate of these statements are that A, P1 sigma 1, P2 sigma 2 equals 0 for bosons, and the commutator equals 0 for fermions, for the A's. Now, actually, we didn't talk about something, we didn't talk about how to normalize these states, how to normalize the P and sigma states. It's really up to us. We can normalize them however is convenient for us. Actually, in a non-relativistic theory, it's very convenient. So the states are labeled by the momentum. Okay. So we can normalize this to be delta sigma sigma prime, so the spin indices are the same, whatever they are. And then whatever the overlap between these are, which you would normally write as delta cubed p minus p prime. Okay, so that's a very convenient normalization. Let me write this just more generally. I'll just write it as delta of p and p prime. And we'll remember what I really mean by that is some actual delta function. Okay? But I don't want to make this big distinction between the momentum indices and the other indices. So I'll use the sort of compressed notation. It turns out in relativistic theories, another reason to do it, in relativistic theories, people sometimes prefer to normalize the states in a way that's more nicely Lorentz invariant. So if you do that, just delta cubed of p minus p prime doesn't transform nicely under Lorentz transformations, but if you multiply by the energy, Ep, the energy associated with that, then that's a nice Lorentz invariant quantity. Okay? But these are all at the moment little, I mean, you'll sort all of this out when you take a proper course. I want to focus on the sort of important structure here. So using this notation is also going to allow me to sweep all the nice normalization issues and so on to what I mean by that delta of p and p prime, so we don't have to drag it around with us. But it's really not, it's not a very essential point. It's our convenience how we decide to normalize these states. But if we do that, then associated with that are the commutation relations for A and A dagger. So A of p and sigma and A dagger of p prime and sigma prime is then delta sigma sigma prime delta p p prime. Okay. Because, well, you just write that state as A dagger on the ground state. That's A on the ground state. And you commute them to have the A hit the ground state and give you zero. And then that just allows you to read off what the commutators. Okay? So this is for bosons and the curly brackets for the fermions. Okay? So I just want to stress, these are operators that we have defined for our convenience. It just makes it easier to talk about all of these states. Instead of thinking about all these states all the time, I can think about all the possible states I get, starting from the ground state and acting with these operators. These operators have simply been defined to generate all the states that I have in the Hilbert space of the theory. Is that clear? I'm stressing this way of talking about it because normally the way you see these things is you start with the fields, you quantize the fields, you go through all the song and dance, and then you find these commutation relations. But this whole point of view is that fields are secondary concepts. The particles are fundamental. Fields are secondary concepts, so I want to build up to that way of thinking about things. So at this point, these have not arisen from any quantization procedure. There's not one deep thing going on here, okay? This is just our convenience. It's just great to talk about these operators. Okay. Let's actually just quickly write down what would be the Hamiltonian. If I just want to write down the Hamiltonian for free particles, what would the Hamiltonian be in terms of these operators? I mean, it's just exactly what you'd expect. The Hamiltonian is just the sum over all the momenta. So this is really an integral. I'll write it down. But once again, I don't want to make such a big distinction between these two indices. AP sigma dagger, AP sigma. That's it. EP, the energy that goes with E. Okay? That's the Hamiltonian. Yes? Yes, there should really be a plus half, which I made a big deal about before, but at the moment we're not talking about gravity, so I've just gotten rid of that. I'm just talking about, yes, there should really be a plus half there, but, okay. So now, once again, let me actually say this once and for all. In a relativistic theory, we would also be labeling the states by their momenta. In the end, remember, we said we're labeling them by the four momentum, but the energy is constrained. So E squared is equal to P squared plus M squared. We can equally label it by the three momentum, if we'd like. So this norm in a Lorentz invariant theory is often written as 2 pi cubed 2 EP delta cubed P minus P prime. Okay. So there's 2 pi's, there's this 2 E. And also, when you integrate, it's natural to integrate D cubed P over 2 pi cubed 2 EP times anything you want to integrate. Now, these little factors of 2 EP are because D cubed P isn't Lorentz invariant under Lorentz transformations, but D cubed P over 2 EP is Lorentz invariant. A simple way of seeing that is that what this really is like a D4P delta of P squared minus M squared. Okay? If I write D4P delta of P squared minus M squared, this is forcing P squared to equal M squared. So this is, I don't want to integrate over all four momenta because the energy is constrained. E squared is equal to P squared plus M squared. So I can put a delta function here. Well, so if you see what this delta function is, this would be integral dE d cubed P and then a delta of E squared minus P squared plus M squared. And then if you just do the integral over the delta function, integral dE delta of E squared minus P squared M squared, E is equal to square root P squared M squared. But if you remember, when you integrate integral delta of f of, well, perhaps I can even say this even more obviously. Let me write dE as dE squared over 2E, which I can do. Right? So then I can do the integral over E squared. The integral over E squared of the delta function just gives me 1, but I have a 1 over 2E there. So this is integral d cubed p over 2E. So this combination, d cubed p over 2e, is a nice Lorentz invariant combination. Okay? Again, this is not very critical, but just because you'll see it like this. It's not very critical right now. So once again, I can make my life easier. I can write this measure down all the time, but here's a trick that will help you when you're manipulating these expressions when you start doing this properly. I find it very convenient to introduce this notation d slash 3p. Just like we talk about h bar to be h over 2 pi, and then you don't have to drag all sorts of 2 pi's around all the time, it's very convenient to define d slash 3p to be d cubed p over 2 pi cubed ep. And then you don't have to drag these. Then every now and then you actually need to unpackage it, but mostly your formulas will look a lot simpler. Anyway, and this also has the advantage that no matter what normalization you want to choose and so on, you can just shove it in what you mean by the definition of the definition of your slash. Okay, so I just gave you the definition of the slash here for Lorentz invariant theory. For non-relativistic theory, this isn't particularly convenient, and so it's fine to actually just have standard d cubed p over 2 pi cubed. Okay, it just changes the normalization of these operators A and A dagger. It just changes what you mean by the commutation relation. Anyway, so if I wanted to write this, I would write it then. I could write it as d slash 3p ep ap sigma dagger ap sigma. Okay. So that's this free Hamiltonian. No interactions. Now, Now let's imagine trying to build interactions. Just so we have some rough idea of the sort of interactions we're going to be talking about, let's imagine we want to somehow encode an interaction where two particles coming in with momentum p1 and p2 will scatter and go out with momentum p3 and p4. Okay? So I want to come up with some interaction that does something vaguely like that. So once again, we can see why these A's and A daggers are such a useful thing, because I can very easily write the sort of interaction Hamiltonian that would go along with that, process, that would make that process happen. What is it? Well, I just have to do something which would involve an integral, something like d3 slash, p1, d3 slash p2, d3 slash p4. Well, clearly, whatever it is, it better conserve momentum. So let's put a delta of p1 plus p4. Should also conserve energy. So delta of ep1 plus ep4. And then it should have something that looks like, for instance, A dagger P4, A dagger P3, A P2, A P1. Maybe it has some indices here, the sigma 4, sigma 3, sigma 2, sigma 1. And then there's some coefficient that this thing has. I don't know, let's call it V, sigma 1, sigma 2, sigma 3, sigma 4. And it can depend on P1, P2, P3, and P4. But what's important here is this string of A's and A daggers. You see, why does that do what we say? That does what we say because this is some interaction Hamiltonian that would take two incoming states. So this thing would act on the initial state P1 and P2. What would it do? That would send them back to the ground state, and this would produce the states P3 and P4. So this interaction Hamiltonian acts on the initial state and gives you the final state. And therefore, in first order in perturbation theory, this would make the process that we're interested in describing there go. Right. So it's very easy to just stare at the interaction Hamiltonian and make a guess, well, and just see the kinds of processes that it corresponds to at zeroth order, at first order in perturbation theory. Well, probably we have to add the Hermitian conjugate of this for the Hamiltonian to be Hermitian and so on. But, and then I can add lots and lots of other interactions as well. But all I want you to see from here is that the interactions are made out of strings of A's and A daggers. Okay? It's also very easy in this picture, to talk about creation and destruction of particles, not just scattering. Okay? For instance, let's say I had two kinds of particles, B and A. Okay? And I want to describe the possibility that B can decay to AAA, B can decay to 3As. Then what would that interaction Hamiltonian look like? It would have something like A dagger, A dagger, A dagger, B. Right? Because that's something that would act on the initial state with a B in it. Okay? That with the particle B in it. The B would remove that from the initial state, send you back to the vacuum, and the rest of them would create the three particles in the final state. Okay? So it's just very convenient to talk about any kind of process that maps between different particle states. Okay? All right. So that's the utility of these A's and A daggers. They package the information of the particles in a very convenient way. So far, we haven't said the word field. Now comes the challenge. If I write down, these are interactions between momentum eigenstates, right? Momentum eigenstates are like big plane waves. If I write down some totally generic random interaction with the V's, actually, let's look at this whole thing, okay? That's really the coefficient I have for all of these guys. But if I write down totally generic coefficient for this, it's not going to be, there's no reason it should physically correspond to point-like interactions between the particles, local interactions between the particles. It is not at all obvious, it is not at all obvious that this would have the property that if you did one set of experiments here or another set of experiments on Alpha Centauri, that the results would factorize into the product of what happens here and the product of what happens in Alpha Centauri. Okay. So what we'd like to do is come up with some engine for building interaction Hamiltonians. In the end, they're just going to be strings of A's and A daggers with some coefficients. Okay? But we'd like to come up with some engine that allows us to build interaction Hamiltonians where we can just see explicitly that the interactions are local. Okay? That's where the utility of the field concept comes in. And, so there's a little more to say about this, but the sort of end result is relatively intuitive. So let me say what it is. The problem is that these states that we've defined act very nicely under the translation operator. They pick up a phase under the translation operator, and that's perfectly fine. But to build interactions that are local in space, we'd like to get X to make an appearance somehow. The X in space we'd like to make an appearance somehow. Okay. So what we'd like to do is build out of these operators other operators where translations act like. We'd like to build out of these other operators phi of X, which are going to be labeled by some X, where phi of X, or under translations, phi of X goes to phi of X plus A. Now, there's a very natural way of doing that. It's called Fourier transformation, right? So what I can do is define a bunch of operators. So let me define, for example, I'll define two of them, phi plus of X to be built out of the A's, of the A daggers, and phi minus of X, which is the Hermitian conjugate of this, to be built out of the A's. So phi minus of X equals phi plus of X dagger. See, it should be clear that now under translations, phi of X goes to phi of X plus A. Right? Because under translations, the states P sigma pick up a phase, e to the I P dot A. In order for that to be the action of the translations on the states, the action on these operators that we defined, A and A dagger, had better be that A picks up a phase, e to the I P dot A. So that means that I get an extra e to the I P dot A here, which I can absorb into just a redefinition of what X is, and so I find that phi plus and phi minus of X go to phi plus minus of X plus A. Now, in fact, it's extremely easy to see that we can go back to this free Hamiltonian, and we can write this free Hamiltonian very simply in terms of these guys. Thank you. Well, for instance, the free Hamiltonian. So let's say I'm doing, let's say I'm just doing non-relativistic physics for a second, okay? So the energy EP is P squared over 2m. So let's say we're just doing that for the, we're just doing non-relativistic stuff. Then H free is, well, what do you think it is? It started off as a sum over momenta. Let me just write down the answer, and then we can. Okay. If you like, that's the grad phi plus dagger. Let's say grad phi plus. Well, whatever it is, it makes sense that it should be an integral over all space, right? So because it should be translationally invariant, whatever it is. The Hamiltonian is translationally invariant, so it better be an integral over all space. And, well, you can see this is reasonable. It's just like standard Fourier transformation stuff, right? So grad phi acts on this like and gives you P. So here, this is where I'm getting the P squared over 2m. That's the energy piece out in front. And there's an A dagger on one side and an A on the other side. And then this D cubed X and the D cubed P's take care of each other to give you the original formula. That's a nice little exercise that you can work through to show that these are the same thing. But I just want you to see why it's a very, very reasonable expression. Okay? But now you see the real utility of this idea starts coming in, because now I can very easily write down interactions in a way that makes it guaranteed that the underlying particles are actually interacting in a local way. For example, I can write down an interaction Hamiltonian, which is d cubed x again, sum phi plus of x, phi plus of x, phi minus of x, phi minus of x. Remember, this is just phi plus of x dagger with some coefficient, c. There's a nice interaction Hamiltonian, okay? Plus other ones, okay? And it's totally clear now this is local in space, because I'm building it out of objects which translate in usual space in the normal way, and so this is making it clear that the interaction is taking place at a point in space. At the point in space x. Of course, it could take place at any point in space, but the interactions between the particles are local in space. Is that clear? Now, you can take this and expand it out, and if you expand it out, what are you going to get? You're going to get something like we just talked about before. You're going to get something with two A's and two A daggers. And all of the rest of it will come along, yes?
Working in a relativistic framework?
Nope. At the moment,
they're working classically. No,
no, no. We're of course it's quantum mechanically. This as I said up here. This is this is just as a simple example is non-relativistic. I can do exactly the same thing. I could do exactly the same thing relativistically. In fact, I'm doing it non-relativistically just to stress that this part of the story has nothing to do with relativity. Okay. This is just the general feature of how to make particles interact in a local way. Particles, both non-relativistically and relativistically, are labeled by momenta and spin. And that's just what they are. They're representations of the corresponding symmetry, of the corresponding symmetries. The reason fields are introduced is to make it convenient to talk about the local interactions of these particles. Just makes it convenient to do so. And it's just as convenient in non-relativistic physics as relativistic physics, which is why the machinery of quantum field theory is used all the time in condensed matter physics. Okay? Just in any many-body situation, this is a very convenient way of talking about things. Now, in normally non-relativistic physics, this is extremely convenient, but it's not critical. Because you can always go back and talk about things in terms of a many-body Schrodinger equation. Okay, Here I'm giving you a way of talking about the Hamiltonian for many particles, okay, where they interact in some way. You could go back and try to write down the Hamiltonian for particles that interact, for a bunch of particles that interact with each other, by writing down a big Schrodinger equation for all those particles. It's easy to show that these two formulations are completely equivalent. Okay, so this is just a way of writing the Hamiltonian, after all. There's nothing fancy about it. Okay, so, but it's, again, it's much more convenient because it makes the locality of interactions manifest, and then it ties into a lot of other beautiful machinery for how you can think about field theory. But it's not critical. It's not conceptually critical. In relativistic situations, it's even conceptually critical because particle number isn't conserved. Okay, we can create and annihilate particles. There just is no such thing as a Schrodinger equation for field theory because the number of particles isn't fixed. There isn't a fixed number of particles Schrodinger equation. It's the only recourse we have is to talk about the Hamiltonian, which would include the possibility of creation and annihilation of particles. And then this is the only picture we have available, okay, for making sure how those particles interact in a way that's local. But I just wanted, yeah, so it's completely trivial to write this down I could equally well have written down that down as phi plus, and then written it down as negative Laplacian over 2m, phi plus, phi minus, or phi plus dagger, phi plus. And then if I want to do this in a relativistic theory, I can put phi plus root, I mean, it's root p squared plus m squared. I can write it in position space. I can write it in a coordinate space. It doesn't make any difference at all. Okay. Okay. So far so good. And it appears that I can do this in a non-relativistic theory, in a relativistic theory. Everything is fine. Okay? So this is why we use fields. It makes local interactions manifest. Local interactions of particles manifest. Now, this is actually also the beginning of the connection with the talk I mentioned I'll be giving in the afternoon, because we may eventually not want to keep locality manifest and keep other things manifest. As I mentioned to you, for very, very deep reasons, we're suspicious of this idea of locality, because of gravity, because of all these much, much deeper questions that we talked about. Space-time perhaps doesn't exist fundamentally, and so on. And yet here we are, hardwiring it right into our description of the interactions of particles. It's a very good idea because they look damn local. And so we're going to do it, and this is the whole beginning. Everything from here follows by analytic continuation. Okay, so we're going to derive everything from this starting point. This is the reason why it's the talk in the afternoon exists, is the attempt to talk about standard physics in a way that doesn't make locality manifest from the start. Yes?
Is the particles obvious in strongly interacting particle theories?
Perhaps not. Perhaps not. And of course, there are situations where the standard notion of a particle doesn't make sense. But in all those situations, they're a small deformation away from one where it does make sense. But you're right. All these arguments are assuming that some notion of particle exists, and we want to talk about how to describe them. Okay. So what's the problem? Where does relativity come in? I just want to stress another thing here, because this, all of these operators that I defined are just functions of x. They're not functions of x and t, right? These are operators in a Hilbert space. I'm not in Heisenberg representation or anything. I'm just in good old-fashioned Schrodinger representation. The operators are fixed things. The Hamiltonian tells you how the state evolves in time. Okay, that's the picture that we've been talking about. Okay. So what is the difficulty? The difficulty has to do with that time evolution. Because quantum mechanics tells you to evolve states in time using the Schrodinger equation, right? But that means in relativity that you pick a frame of reference and you evolve in time in that frame of reference. There's no guarantee at all that two different observers in different frames of reference will agree on the state that has been produced by evolution. Because time plays such a critical role in the standard formulation of quantum mechanics. It's weird. Okay? So let's try to see what we might be able to do about that. Well, the first thing that you might be able to do is just to sort of have a hope. Is imagine you have this is a spatial surface in one frame, and I'm saying that there's a state. So to specify state, I can just give you some initial state vector, which is associated with this first, you know, some state that lives now in my frame, right? So it's on an entire space-like surface. Then I can evolve in time from psi initial here. I can evolve in time to psi final. Well, first of all, even those choices of space-like surfaces are breaking Lorentz invariants, right? So that so there's no way that this a different Lorentz observer would just see these as different spatial surfaces. Okay, so that doesn't even have a hope of being a Lorentz invariant object. But there is something that has a hope of being a Lorentz invariant, which is if you imagine going all the way out to infinity, and you throw in a bunch of particles from infinity, and then have them go back out to infinity. Everybody agrees on where infinity is. Okay, so that question, the question of throw particles in from infinity, have them go back out to infinity, that's a question that at least has a hope of having the observers agree on what the answer is. Okay? So that problem is called, so finding that, the answer to that question is, that's a so-called S matrix, okay? Or the scattering amplitude. I throw in a bunch of states, P1, sigma 1, up to Pn, sigma n, at t equals minus infinity. And they scatter, they do whatever they want. I get some, and at infinity, I get some new state, which is called S on this initial state. And there's a hope then that this unitary transformation that evolves from t equals minus infinity to t equals plus infinity, so S is just the evolution operator from minus infinity to plus infinity. There's a hope that this might be Lorentz invariant, okay? That it acts on a state so that different observers would agree on what that unitary transformation was. Of course, different observers would think that the momenta and energies of the particles were different, but the mapping between one set and another set would be exactly the same for them. Okay? So let's go and try to figure out what S is. Let's try to figure out what S is in a totally general theory, and then see what it would take for it to be Lorentz invariant. Sure, it doesn't look like it's going to be Lorentz invariant again because of this, because time evolution is picking out given is just what we said. This object is the only hope you can have to be Lorentz invariant, but it's still by far not guaranteed that it will be. We have to look to see if it's possible. Okay? And we'll see that with the very special choices of what these interactions look like, very, very special choices, it will barely be possible to make it Lorentz invariant. Okay. Those special choices will force on us the existence of antiparticles and the connection between spin and statistics, as we'll see in some detail. Yeah?
So I'm probably not appreciating what the difficulty is in quantum mechanics, but we have classical theories which are Lorentz invariant,
yes.
And we have evolution in those theories all the time. And different observers will choose different time slices of space-time. So what is the problem in quantum mechanics?
It's just because hardwired into the formalism of quantum mechanics is that you must pick one time and do evolution in that time. Okay? So of course you're right. We of course talk about evolution in a classical Lorentz invariant theory by talking about time evolution. That's fine. But it's hardwired into the formalism of Lorentz invariant theories that it doesn't matter. Whereas in quantum mechanics, you're told to pick a Hamiltonian. The Hamiltonian is king. You pick a Hamiltonian and you evolve in time. Okay? But now it's not at all because it's so tied to time plays a very central role in a more central role in quantum mechanics. It's by far not guaranteed that any old Hamiltonian would correspond to something that looks Lorentz invariant. Okay? In fact, as we'll see, it's barely possible that it's Lorentz invariant. All right. Well, in order to talk about this. There's something annoying that we should get rid of right away, which is just free evolution. Okay? Free evolution, just not evolving at all. Free evolution is just making the states evolve with a phase, right? Okay, that's a totally irrelevant part of this problem, because it will keep evolving with a phase out to infinity. Okay? Out to infinity on one side, out to infinity on the other side. That's not the interesting part. That's not the interesting part of the scattering that we're interested in. So fortunately, there's a very standard way of removing. So let's say you have a Hamiltonian, which has a free part and an interacting part. Then there's a very standard way of sort of getting rid of the free evolution and just focusing on the interesting part from the get-go. This is called going to the interaction representation. How many of you guys have seen this in a quantum mechanics course? Okay, so many of you haven't. So let's do it. So let's say we're interested in solving this Schrodinger equation. Okay. Now, if the interaction wasn't there, we know that the solution would have been psi is equal to e to the negative I h free t on psi of 0, right? If h int is 0, so h int equals 0, psi is e to the negative I h free t times psi of t equals 0, say, times psi initial. So that's a unitary matrix, e to the negative I free t, times psi initial. Okay, that's not what we don't have quite a free theory. But if the interaction is small, it's going to be pretty close to evolving like this. Okay? So that means that it's a good idea to write. It's a good idea to write a new psi as e to the I h free t psi in the interaction representation, psi capital I. This defines what psi is in the interaction representation. Okay? If h int equals 0, then this state psi int doesn't evolve at all. Oops. Yeah, at all. So that's good. Okay. So we've stripped off this irrelevant. We've stripped off this irrelevant just phase from evolving along. But because there's h int, psi will evolve. So let's figure out what the equation is for psi. Okay. Well, so. If I look at I dh bar, I h bar ddt psi, This is equal to the one term of the IH bar. Oh, I'm sorry. You know what? I'm putting H bar to 1, right? H bar is 1. So I don't have to remember that there's water H bars everywhere. Okay, so I d psi dt is, there's the one term where the I d dt hits the exponential. That breaks down an HF psi int. Oh. Sorry. That brings down HF times e to the negative I HT psi int, which is just psi, plus the term where it's e to the negative I HF H free T. Times ddt I ddt psi int. So that's on the one hand what it is from this definition. On the other hand, this is what we just said. It's h free plus h int. Times psi, which is e to the minus I h free t psi in the interaction representation. Sorry? Do I need a negative I here? No, because it's multiplied by I. Okay. All right, so of course, very nicely, the HF, that's HF psi, that cancels on that side, and we get an equation for I dt psi int, which is what we wanted. And I find that I ddt psi in the interaction representation is equal to e to the plus I hft h int e to the negative I h free t psi int. Okay, well, this sort of makes sense, right? You're used to sometimes going from the Schrodinger picture to the Heisenberg picture. But when you do that, normally the Heisenberg picture, you use the whole Hamiltonian, right? And then what you find is that, so we normally deal with the whole Hamiltonian. Here we're doing it with the free part of the Hamiltonian. And so what we're finding is what we're finding is that in the interaction, this interaction psi is evolving according to the interaction Hamiltonian in the Heisenberg picture you would have gotten if you just used the free Hamiltonian. Okay. So let's call this object HI. Okay. This is the interaction Hamiltonian in the interaction representation. Okay. So now we have IDDT psi int is equal to HI psi int. Oops, yeah. And let me call, instead of psi int all the time, I'll call all of them I from now on. Okay. Notice something important, that let's say H int, original interaction, was time independent. This will in general be time dependent, right? Just some general time dependent Hamiltonian. Maybe I'll keep that here just to remind me that it could very well be time dependent. Okay. Now we're going to formally solve this equation. Just the same way as that when it's time independent, we just immediately write the solution that psi is e to the negative iht psi naught. We want to do exactly the same thing here, just formally solve it. But we can't just write it as e to the negative iht psi naught because why? Because h is time dependent. Okay. So how do we formally solve this? Well, we just integrate. So I say psi I at time t2 is equal to just the integral of this equation. So it's psi I at time t1 minus I, the integral from T1 to T2, let's call it dt, H interaction psi I of t. I'm just integrating right and left between T1 and T2. Okay? This doesn't seem to have bought us very much, except we can keep going. Let me, in here, put this exactly the same solution. So this is psi I of T1 minus I, the integral from T1 to T2, dt. So this would be hi, again, psi I of T1 plus minus I, the integral from T1 to now just t, dt prime, psi I of t prime, hi of t prime. Thank you very much. Okay, so let's just write this out again with feeling. Psi I of T1 minus I integral of T1 to T2 dt hi of t psi I of T1. And then minus I squared integral T1 to T2 dt integral T1 to t dt prime hi of t prime psi I of t prime. I'm just trivially writing that back out again. Okay. Okay, well, the pattern is clear. I can just keep on going. So what I'll get formally what I get is that psi I of T2 is something on psi I of T1. And the something is 1 plus minus I integral T1 to t T2 dt hi of t plus minus I squared integral T1 to T2 integral T1 to t dt dt prime hi of t prime plus minus I cubed integral T1 to T2 T1 to t T1 to t prime dt dt prime dt double prime hi of t hi t prime hi of t double prime plus dot 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 this whole mess multiplied by psi I of T1. And of course, if this interaction Hamiltonian is small, then this is giving us some nice perturbation theory, right? So I might just truncate somewhere and just keep the terms that I have. Now, people write this expression in a very nice, using a very nice notation, which is just motivated by a very simple observation. Let's look at this second term. This second term is an integral over what region? It's a double integral, but it's a double integral that goes from T1 to T2, an integral in TT prime space, okay, where the T integral goes from T1 to T2. So this is the T direction. This is the T prime direction. And the T prime integral just goes from T1 to T. So it's an integral over this lower triangle in the T1, T2 plane. Okay? It would be very nice to write it as an integral over the whole region, where both T1 and T2 go, both T and T prime go from T1 and T2. Okay? Well, you can do that. I can write this integral. I can write the integral hi of T, hi of T prime, over this little triangular region as 1/2 of the integral over the whole region of something that you could call the time-ordered product of hi of t and hi of t prime, where this is defined the time-ordered product of any two operators A of B, A of t, B of t prime, is just equal to A of t, B of t prime, if t is bigger than t prime, and it's equal to A is equal to B of t prime, A of t, if t is less than t prime. Okay? So all I'm doing is just trivially writing it. I'm just multiplying by 2, allowing myself to have the integral over the other side. But in this region, instead of integrating hi of t, hi of t prime, I'm switching them around. Okay? So that's just exactly the same integral, but I divide by a factor of 2. So it's clear that if you're going to do this for the three-dimensional integral, you divide by a factor of 3 factorial. In general, you divide by a factor of n factorial. And so another way of writing this, another way of writing the thing that appears in the square brackets is as 1 plus negative I, so this piece, you didn't need anything, t dt hi of t. Of course, you could just call this the time-ordered product of hi of t with 1. So That's nothing. Plus negative I squared over 2 factorial, the integral T1 to T2, dt, dt prime, the time-ordered product of hi of t, hi of t prime, plus the thing with negative I cubed over 3 factorial, the integral T1 to T2, dt prime, dt double prime, the time-ordered dt prime, dt double prime, time-ordered product of hi, t, hi of t prime, hi of t double prime, plus so on. This is just notation. There's no content to it other than just a way of rewriting. I mean, just notation for writing these kinds of nested integrals. But it's a very nice notation because it reminds you that time ordering is the critical issue here. And so you can end by writing this expression in the following form. It's the time-ordered product of e to the negative I, the integral from T1 to T2, dt hi of t. Acting on psi I of T1. That's a nice formula because let's say hi of T commuted with itself at all times. If it commuted with itself at all times, then this time ordering is irrelevant. And then this formula is really nothing other than e to the negative I ht, okay? Which is correct. E to the negative I h t2 minus t1 acting on psi I of t. All right. So, in particular then, if I'm evolving from plus infinity to minus infinity, psi at plus infinite time would be the time-ordered product, e to the negative I, the integral from minus infinity to infinity, dt h I of t times psi I at negative infinity. Bigger chart. Yes. Definitely not. Gosh. Okay. Now let's go back to field theory. Okay. Remember, we were building our interaction Hamiltonian out of these fields, like phi plus of x is the integral d cubed p e to the I p dot x a p and sigma. Oh, sorry, I forgot to say that there's a sigma here. So I should also be summing over some Let's for the moment just imagine we're talking about scalars, okay? So that they don't have any spin index. Okay, just we'll go back and put in the spin in a second. I'm sorry. When I was talking about the five plus and minus before, we didn't put in anything with the sigmas. Okay, so it's extreme. Well, so when you're building fields out of them, you should, in general, we would put phi plus of x is the integral d cubed p like that, and then we'd have some e to the I p dot x, and then it would be some a p and sigma, and then something, some coefficient here, c sigma that depends on p as well. Okay, so we would put these guys together in this way to make things that behave nicely under translations. But for this discussion, I didn't put that in, and let's ignore it for the moment. I'll come back and talk about spin in a second. So let's say we're just talking about scalars. They don't have any spin. Okay, so if we want to build we have to talk about the Hamiltonian in the interaction representation now, right? So we talked about how to build the Hamiltonian before in terms of these phi plus, phi minus, stuff like that. Now, for this formalism, we're going into the interaction representation. Okay? So in the interaction representation, instead of all these, my Hamiltonian will be built out of phi plus, phi minus in the interaction representation. So I should talk about some new phi interaction representation plus, which is now going to depend on x and t, which is e to the negative I h free t, just like we did before, right? Phi of x, e to the I h free t. Okay, well, this is really easy, because I know exactly how these operators evolve under time. They just pick up a factor of the energy, right? That's they go like e to the I ep. I know how the free Hamiltonian acts on AP, and it just gives us, I put the dagger there before, we just get factors of the energy. So this just becomes the integral d3p e to the I p dot x e to the negative I dpt times ap dagger. So that's nice, because this is precisely, so this is an integral d3 slash p e to the negative I p mu x mu acting on ap dagger. And because that measure that we chose was a Lorentz invariant measure, this is actually a nice phi plus is now a nice, behaves nicely under Lorentz transformations. Okay. So I have phi plus of x, this is now of x mu, this is in the interaction representation, okay. phi plus of x mu is just, well, just what I wrote, behaves nicely under Lorentz transformations. In fact, it's just that this is phi plus of lambda x is just equal to phi plus of x. Just that simple. All right, so we seem to be actually in awesome shape. Let's go and just try to write down that interaction we just talked about a second ago. I mean, let's try to write down any old, in fact, let's just try to write down any old interesting interaction we might like. I might imagine having any interaction, any h int, which now in the interaction representation will become an integral over space, d cubed x. Then I can have some strings of phi pluses of x in the interaction representation, phi minuses of x in the interaction representation. Okay. Now notice this is an integral over just space. It's the interaction Hamiltonian. It's an integral over space. Now in the interaction representation, all of these phi pluses and phi minuses depend on x and t. They're functions of x mu. Okay, but this seems a little bit nice. These guys are transformed nicely under Lorentz transformation, so everything seems nice. Of course, that d cubed x doesn't transform nicely. That's just an integral over space, right? But let's go back and write down our formula. So we have the time ordering, e to the negative I, the integral from over all times dt of hi. But the integral over hi is the integral d cubed x. Now I have phi plus I of x, some string of them, phi minus I of x, some string of them, whatever I like, with some coefficients, right, some kappas. Okay. That's not important for the moment. Something very nice happened here. That now is just d4x, just the integral over all of space-time. That's a nice Lorentz invariant concept. So now we have time-ordered e to the negative I, the integral d4x of something which is built out of fields that transform nicely under Lorentz transformations. So that's our operator. That's our S matrix that takes us from minus infinity to plus infinity. Oh, this looks awesome. Everything inside here is Lorentz invariant. That transforms nicely under Lorentz transformations. That's Lorentz invariant. This whole quantity in here is Lorentz invariant. So great, we're done. The theory is Lorentz invariant. What's the problem? There's one symbol on the board here which is not obviously Lorentz invariant. The big T out in front, okay? That's the only place here that possible Lorentz, that's the only thing which is not necessarily a Lorentz invariant notion, okay? In fact, let's say it more generally. So we've managed to write this in a way. We've managed apparently to write this in a way that looks like the time-ordered product e to the negative I integral d4x, the interaction you might want to call it some interaction Hamiltonian density, okay, of x. This was the big interaction Hamiltonian, which was written as an integral d cubed x, but somehow there is a quantity which is the, you can call it the interaction Hamiltonian density. Let me write it even curlier. Okay. And it appears that this interaction Hamiltonian density is a nice Lorentz invariant thing. It's built out of Lorentz invariant fields. Everything is nice and Lorentz invariant. Okay. So this whole thing would be Lorentz invariant if time ordering was Lorentz invariant. Unfortunately, time ordering is not Lorentz invariant. Okay? Remember, we're integrating over all of d4x here. Okay? If it was the case that the time ordering between any two points in Minkowski space, any two random points in Minkowski space, if that time ordering was a Lorentz invariant notion, then we'd be done. This thing would be obviously Lorentz invariant. But it isn't. If I have two points, if I have one point which is inside the light cone of another point, then their time ordering is Lorentz invariant. Right? So if this is one point, and I have another point here, and it's inside the light cone of this one, then it's always in the future of it under Lorentz transformations. But as we discussed before, if you have a point that's outside, then under Lorentz transformations, you can change the time ordering. You can make it earlier, you can make it later. So time ordering is not a Lorentz invariant notion. So what is the only way that this thing can be, what is the only way then that this thing can be Lorentz invariant? It had better be that if we have two points, x and x prime, which are not, which are space-like separated, okay, so that x prime is not in the light cone of x. Okay? It had better be that when x and x prime are space-like separated, hi of x commutes with hi of x prime. If that happens, then despite the fact that the time ordering isn't Lorentz invariant, the time ordered product will be. Because in that situation, the time ordering isn't, but if they commute, then it didn't matter anyway. Okay? That's all we can do. Otherwise, we're totally sunk. Okay? So for this to be Lorentz invariance implies forces that this density hi of x should commute with itself if x minus x prime squared is less than 0. Okay. Space-like, separated. So is at least the logic clear? So you see, and this is really the answer to your question from before, right? You just see the formalism of quantum mechanics, everything is sailing along, but the fact that there's an underlying time there is waiting to bite you, okay? And it can only give us something Lorentz invariant if this interaction Hamiltonian density commutes with itself outside the light cone. Yeah?
How do you construct Hamiltonians that
satisfy this property? That's the entire challenge. Okay, that is the now it's the entire challenge. In fact, so let me actually tell you what happens. It would have been absolutely awesome if we can just take those fields phi plus and phi minus, and if we compute the commutator of, let's say you just compute the commutator of phi plus with itself, the commutator of phi plus of x phi plus of x prime. Okay. You can ask, is that thing, does it vanish outside the light cone? No, it does not. Okay. So that's a very nice exercise. The commutator of phi plus with itself does not vanish outside the light cone, nor phi minus with itself. What you find is that a particular combination of phi plus and phi minus, you can build a new object, particular combination of phi plus and phi minus where the commutator does vanish outside the light cone. So now I'm just stating results. So this is, but just again in the spirit of logical structure. So it turns out that fields like phi plus of x, phi minus of x, phi plus of x prime does not equal 0 for x minus x prime squared equals 0. Less than 0. What you need to do is build a new field, capital phi of x, which is like phi plus of x plus phi minus of x, that combination. Okay. So phi plus of x plus five plus of x dagger, if you like. Okay. Well, but let me write it like this: 5 plus and 5 minus. This is the more familiar thing that you often see in books when you start quantizing fields. You see expressions that look like d3/p ap e to the minus ipx plus ap dagger plus ap e to the ipx. Okay? And that's normally the sort of thing that you see right away in the beginning as you start quantizing things. But this is actually, it's a very derived thing. Okay? And from this point of view, it turns out that this combination, this sort of object, so capital, this phi of x commutes with itself outside the light cone. The commutators cancel between the various terms. And this is equal to 0 for x minus x prime squared less than 0. But it tells us something quite significant. It tells us that we have to build HI out of phi, out of the combination phi. Not phi plus phi minus separately, which we could easily have done in non-relativistic physics. Okay? By the way, I just snuck in something here, because it turns out that these things commute with each other outside the light cone. I was talking about scalars. They commute with each other out of the light cone only if we take commutation relations for the A and the A dagger, not anti-commutation relations between A and A dagger. If we take anti-commutation relations between the A and A dagger, they don't commute with each other outside the light cone. So we learned that for scalars, particles of spin zero, we have no choice. They must be bosons. Particles of spin zero could be fermions from the point of view of just quantum mechanics. Non-relativistic quantum mechanics, there's no trouble, right? Particles have... that there's no trouble at all. But we learned that if we're trying to describe particles of spin zero, I've attempted to call them fermions, and that's fine, but you can never build a Lorentz invariant theory out of them. Okay? The commutator of the Hamiltonian has got to vanish outside the light cone, and that's only possible for scalars if they're bosons, and it tells you that you have to build the interactions out of capital phi. Now, we're about to learn something else quite dramatic just in a moment. Let's actually see what kind of terms what sort of terms could we be talking about? For instance, I could be saying that H interaction is like, that this H interaction, the analog of what we did before that had phi plus, phi minus, two particles scattering going back out. The analog would be, well, it would be something like phi to the fourth of x, maybe with some coefficient. Okay. But if I expand that out in terms of phi plus and phi minus, I learn something interesting. That's it's phi plus phi minus to the fourth. So this contains pieces that look like what we talked about before, phi plus squared, phi minus squared. But it also has pieces that look like phi plus to the fourth or phi plus phi minus cubed, okay, and so on. Why is that significant? That's significant because it means I'm describing here a sort of a single scalar, right? But it means that when we were talking about this interaction, what it was doing things like two scalars come along and they bang into each other. Two come in, two go out. Or, for instance, I might collide two of them. Well, anyway, two go in, two go out. The particle number is conserved. Okay, but these other interactions allow things to happen where the particle number isn't conserved. For instance, you might imagine one going in, three going out. Okay? So we've done all this work and we've managed to construct a nice Lorentz invariant theory. It's a nice Lorentz invariant theory for some kind of scalar particle. But whatever it is, this scalar particle doesn't have any sort of charges that are conserved associated with it. I can create it and destroy it at will. Right? There's no conserved charge associated with this guy. Well, what if we wanted to talk about something where the particle did have some kind of conserved charge? Imagine some scalar version of the electron. So it had electric charge. Okay? If it had electric charge, we're stuck. This is not going to describe any particle with electric charge because they could lose electric charge. So what do we do? Well, we only have one choice. We have to introduce A's and B's. In other words, we have to introduce two different kinds of phi. Okay? So we have to say that there's a phi of an A type, which would be the integral of A, P dagger, e to the I, PX, P dot X, and also of a B type, which is the integral B dagger, e to the I, P dot X. And it turns out that argument about the commutator, as you can see pretty easily, actually, the argument about the commutator only relied on the cross terms here in the 5x, 5x prime, right? Because A and A dagger commute or anti-commute with each other. So the extent to which it worked only needed to know about the commutator of A and its dagger and B and its dagger. Okay? But what I have to do is build a new phi to be built out of the phi A plus phi B minus. In other words, I have to build this out of the integral v3/p ap e to the I p dot x plus bp dagger e to the minus I p dot x. This was my right. Well, so in the interaction representation, it would just be that. Okay. This guy still satisfies that his commutator vanishes. 5x vanishes for x minus x prime equal for x minus x prime space like separated. But now I can write down, you see, the old phi that I defined was actually Hermitian. It was made out of something plus its dagger. This new phi is not Hermitian anymore. But I can write down, interactions that would look like phi dagger of x squared, phi of x squared, for example. That's a nice interaction that I can write down. And if you expand this out, you'll see that that everything would conserve charge, provided that whatever the particles are, whatever charge you say particles A have, the particle B has the opposite charge. The fact that particle B has got to have opposite charge of particle A is actually obvious. If you think about what the charge would, let's say there is a conserved charge, so there's an operator in the Hilbert space, and so e to the I q theta would act on these fields in some way. The charge acts on these fields in some way. Okay? And it acts on them to give a phase on A. And if the charge is going to be well defined on phi, it needs to give whatever phase it gives on A, it has to give the same phase on B dagger. So that means that B itself would have to have the opposite phase. So A and B have opposite charges. And you can also see that if you just expand this out, that if you wrote down other things, if you wrote down phi to the fourth of x plus Hermitian conjugate, then still, charge isn't conserved. Okay? But with this choice, and with the assignment that A has the opposite charge of B, then this is a Hamiltonian that conserves charge. But you see that if you want to talk about particles that carry any kind of well-defined charge, you must have antiparticles. Okay? Once again, there's no choice. So if you like, we went through all this effort to build a theory for just a single scalar particle, but we found that there's no conserved charge associated with it. Okay? Precisely because of relativity. Notice the difference, right? Non-relativistically, nothing stopped me from writing down phi plus, phi plus, phi minus, phi minus. That does carry a nice, that looks a lot like that, right? Except with phi pluses alone. So that has a nice charge. Okay, particle number is conserved. Everything is fine. Just isn't Lorentz invariant. The only way to make that theory Lorentz invariant makes it impossible for the charge to be conserved. We can interpret that in this new language by saying the particle is its own antiparticle in that case. It's possible because it doesn't have any conserved charges. So if there are no conserved charges, you can have a particle and you can say it's its own antiparticle. That's just a convenience of language. Okay, but if there is a conserved charge, then you cannot possibly talk about it with just a single species of particle. Even though you can non-relativistically, you can't relativistically, you must double the spectrum of the theory. There must exist antiparticles. And furthermore, they must be grouped together in this very, very precise way. Okay? So we have to build fields out of things that make particles and antiparticles. If you repeat this whole argument and go back and put those C's, put those factors in for the spins to talk about fermions and everything, you find exactly the same conclusions, except you find that the spin a half particles have to satisfy anti-commutation relations in order for the commutators to vanish outside the light cone. So that's where the connection between spin and statistics comes from, even and odd in general. Antiparticles is a totally generic consequence. Notice nowhere here have we talked about the Dirac equation, nowhere here have we done, if we did spin a half particles, we would see the Dirac equation would be a sort of trivial kinematic statement about the particles having spin a half. But it carries no dynamical content whatsoever. Okay? It's just one of the labels that spin a half particles have. And when you talk about it relativistically, you it's convenient. The variables are a convenient are convenient, but it doesn't have any dynamical content. Okay, so I've finished sketching out the logic for we start from particles are the irreducible representations of the symmetries that we have. If you want to put them together, if you want to talk about them, talk about the Hilbert space associated with them in a convenient way, you use raising and lowering operators that have commutation or anti-commutation relations depending on whether the particles are bosons or fermions. If you want to make sure that those particles are having local interactions in space, you group them up into fields, and you write down interaction Hamiltonians that are the interaction of Hamiltonian densities over space made out of those fields. You can do this in non-relativistic physics or relativistic physics, according to taste. But in relativistic physics, it takes on extra life. And you need to build very special sorts of interaction Hamiltonians in order to guarantee that the physics is Lorentz invariant. You have to ensure that these interaction Hamiltonians commute with each other outside the light cone, and that forces both the connection between the spin and statistics and the existence of antiparticles. Okay? So when we come back, we will take off from here and start talking about everything else. Okay.